Good morning and welcome to the Flight Logic Brief. It is Friday, August 14th, 2026. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. And Alex, I gotta say, I looked at the fuel number this morning before coffee and it did the job of the coffee.
Yeah, that's where we're starting. Because that number is the story today.
It's $8.31, $8.31 a gallon for Jet A.
National average. And we'll get into exactly whose average that is in a second. But we've also got a really interesting split in the fractional world. We've got Beta Technologies clearing a genuinely meaningful certification hurdle with the Federal Aviation Administration. We've got the National Transportation Safety Board preliminary on the Ryanair blade out at Thessaloniki. And there's an Airbus engineering analysis floating around on an Air India A320 that briefly lost primary flight control functions.
That last one. We have to spend time on that one.
We will. Plus a United evacuation in Denver over a live round found in the cabin, and Airbus pulling away from Boeing on deliveries again.
Busy Friday, let's go, source Aviation Week Bizav.
So, Jet A. Aviation Research Group runs a monthly survey of more than 200 U.S. fixed base operators, FBOs, and the August number came in at an average of $8.31 a gallon.
Which by itself is a number, but the deltas are the story.
Right, that's up 70 cents from July. Month over month, and it's up $1.70 compared to a year ago.
70 cents in 1 month, Alex, that's not a drift. That's a step change. And $1.70 year over year is, what, call it 26, 27%.
Somewhere in there.
So think about what that does to a mid-size cabin operator. You're burning, what, 200 gallons an hour in a super mid? 220? That's $150 an hour of pure fuel costs that appeared out of nowhere versus last summer. On a four-hour leg, that's $600 you didn't budget.
And the retail FBO number is the top of the range. Most Part 45 and Part 91K operators are buying on contract fuel. They're using a card program. They're tankering where it makes sense.
Sure, but contract fuel moves with the index. It lags, it doesn't escape. And here's the thing that I think gets lost. The fuel surcharge mechanics on charter are usually tied to a trailing average. So the operator eats it first, then the customer sees it 30, 60 days later.
Which means the margin compression is happening right now, this month, and the pass-through is a Q4 conversation.
Exactly. And if you're a flight department manager listening to this, this is the moment to go relook at your tankering policy. Because when the spread between your cheap fields and your expensive fields widens, and it always widens when the average goes up, the math on carrying fuel changes.
Though carrying fuel costs you fuel.
It does. Rule of thumb, you burn roughly 3 to 4% of the extra fuel you're hauling per hour of flight, so it's not free. But at $8.30 a gallon retail versus, I don't know, $5 and change at a good field, the arbitrage is real again in a way it hasn't been for a couple years.
Okay, so that's the headwind. Here's what I find genuinely interesting. Demand did not blink.
No, it did not.
Aviation Week's tracked aircraft utilization data for May through July. NetJets up 10% in aggregate flight hours year over year. FlexJet up 11%.
Double digits. In a period where fuel went up $1.70.
And that's against a strong prior year comp. That's not recovering from a hole.
That's the part that gets me. Those are the two biggest fractional providers in the world, and they're both putting up 10, 11% growth. That is not a market where the customer is price sensitive.
But it's not uniform. VistaJet, Wheels Up, and Fly Exclusive all posted declines in the same window.
And that's the word Aviation Week used. Bifurcated. And I think that's exactly right. You've got the fractional share model, where the customer has already bought in, they've got the capital committed, they've got the guaranteed availability. That customer flies.
And then you've got the membership and on-demand side.
Where the customer can just not fly this month, or shop it, or take an empty leg. The demand elasticity is completely different depending on which side of that line you sit on.
It's also a fleet story, isn't it? NetJets and FlexJet have both been taking a lot of new metal.
Huge amounts. And newer airplanes fly more, better dispatch reliability, fewer unscheduled maintenance events, and frankly, better fuel burn per seat mile, which matters a lot more at 831 than it did at 660.
Now zoom out one more level, because the broader picture is actually healthy. Across all the main operator classes, corporate, fractional, charter, private, utilization in May through July was up versus 2025 and up versus 2019.
Versus 2019 is the number I always come back to. We are 7 years past the pre-pandemic baseline and business aviation is still structurally flying more than it did then.
Corporate is the biggest class by a wide margin, more than 21,700 aircraft tracked.
which people forget. Everybody talks about the fractionals because they're loud and they're branded, but the corporate flight department fleet dwarfs them. That's where most of the airplanes actually are.
And the growth rate there has moderated into single digits.
Which is good. That's what you want. You don't want 20% year over year forever. That's how you get an oversupply hangover in 2028. Single-digit growth off a permanently higher base is a healthy market. That's a market that can absorb a fuel shock without falling over.
All right, let's shift from what's flying today to what's going to be flying in a couple of years. Beta Technologies had a meaningful week.
Oh, this one's underrated. Everybody's chasing eVTOL headlines, electric vertical takeoff and landing. And the actually important Beta news is about a regulatory interpretation.
Right. So Beta resolved a regulation interpretation issue with the FAA that had been holding up the certification path for the H500A. That's their electric cruise engine.
And people hear interpretation issue, and their eyes glaze over. Don't let them. This is the entire ballgame for electric propulsion.
Explain that.
So the engine certification rules, Part 33, were written for things that burn fuel. They talk about fuel systems. They talk about ingestion. They talk about things that have no analog in an electric motor. And conversely, there's a whole category of stuff an electric power plant does that the rule never contemplated. Thermal runaway, inverter failure modes. What continuous power even means when your limit is thermal, not mechanical.
So who decides how the rule applies?
That's the interpretation. And until you and the agency agree on what the rule means for your specific architecture, you cannot build a certification plan, which means you can't build a test plan, which means you can't spend money efficiently. You're just burning cash waiting.
So clearing that unblocks the whole downstream.
It unblocks everything. And it's not just Beta. Whatever precedent gets set here gets looked at by everybody else building an electric power plant. This is one of those quiet moments that ends up in the history of how electric aviation got certified.
And on the airframe side, Beta completed the requirements definition for certification of the ALIA CX300. That's the conventional takeoff and landing version.
The fixed wing one, which honestly I think is the horse to bet on before the vertical stuff. It's a simpler airplane, it's a simpler certification basis, and the mission, short-haul cargo, feeder routes, medical logistics, that mission exists today and gets flown today by caravans and barons.
Requirements definition sounds like an early milestone, though.
It sounds early. It's actually the gate. Requirements definition means you and the FAA have written down, in detail, everything the airplane has to prove. Once that's locked, the rest is execution. It's expensive execution, but it's known execution. The scary part of certification is the unknown scope.
Contrast that with Vertical Aerospace, who are also moving, but with a caveat.
Yeah, the caveat's a big one.
So Vertical is advancing toward production of certification-conforming aircraft for the Volo. That's the commercial branding on the VX4, and they're targeting a certification design freeze by the end of 2026.
Design freeze by year end. That's a real milestone. That means you stop changing the airplane and you start proving the airplane.
But questions persist about funding for the UK-based company.
And that is the eVTOL sector in one sentence, isn't it? The engineering is going better than most skeptics expected. The balance sheets are going worse than most optimists expected.
Design freeze also means your burn rate goes up, not down.
Way up, because now you're building conforming articles. You're building airplanes that have to be manufactured to the exact approved configuration with traceability on every part in a quality system the agency has signed off on. Conforming hardware is enormously more expensive than prototype hardware.
So the most capital-intensive phase arrives right when the funding question is loudest.
Every single time. And look, I don't say that to dunk on Vertical. They've done credible flight test work. But the pattern in this sector has been that the company that gets certified isn't necessarily the company with the best airplane. It's the company that still has money when the certification finish line finally shows up.
And for our listeners, the practical question is fleet mix. If you're running a Part 135 operation or a corporate department, does any of this touch you in the next 24 months?
Touches you at the margins. The CX300 class airplane could show up in short-haul cargo and organ transport and coastal feeder work inside that window. The vertical lift stuff, the urban air mobility vision, I'd push that out further. But here's what does touch you sooner. Infrastructure. Charging at FBOs. Ground handling procedures for high-voltage aircraft. Fire response training for lithium events on the ramp. That stuff has to get figured out before the airplanes arrive, and your home field is going to have opinions about it.
Good point. One more from Aviation Week, and this one's a people story. The Air Charter Association launched an internship program.
And I want to flag why this is interesting, because on its face, Trade Group launches internship is the least exciting headline of the week.
It is. 15 students, three-part program.
15 students. It's tiny. But the approach is the story. Business aviation has historically been extremely reserved about public promotion of itself. The whole culture is discretion. That's the product, right? Privacy, confidentiality.
Which is terrible for recruiting.
It's catastrophic for recruiting. Nobody grows up saying, I want to be a charter broker, because nobody has ever heard of a charter broker. Airlines have a pipeline problem, but at least an 18-year-old knows airlines exist. Business aviation has an awareness problem that sits underneath the pipeline problem.
And it's not just pilots.
It's not remotely just pilots. It's dispatchers, it's schedulers, it's maintenance controllers, it's brokers, it's cabin crew. Those roles are hemorrhaging people, and there's no visible on-ramp. So a trade association deciding to be loud about it, genuinely, that's a cultural shift, even at 15 students.
Small program, right instinct.
Small program, right instinct. Do it again next year with 150, bah. Source, Corporate Jet Investor.
Speaking of demand holding up, this connects directly. Corporate Jet Investor reporting on LunaJets, the Geneva-based charter booking platform. They posted their strongest month in company history in July.
What were the numbers?
Just under 15% year-over-year revenue growth and a 25% increase in new customers.
Okay, so hold on. 25% growth in new customers and 15% in revenue. Those numbers don't move together.
Which tells you what?
It tells you the average ticket is going down. You're bringing in a lot more customers, but each one is spending less than your existing base, which is either really good news or a warning sign depending on how you read it.
Make the bull case.
Bull case. New customers start small. Somebody tries charter for the first time, they book a light jet leg, they see how it works, and then next year they're booking transatlantic. Customer acquisition at the top of the funnel always looks like lower average revenue. That's normal and it's healthy. You're building a base.
And the bear case?
Bear case is your existing high-value customers are trading down. They're flying the same number of legs but picking a phenom instead of a challenger because they're feeling the same cost pressure everyone else is feeling. And that shows up as revenue growth lagging customer growth too.
Can you tell which from the outside?
Not from a press release. But here's the tell I'd watch. Brokers like LunaJets sit between the operator and the customer. And in a market where fuel is spiking, the broker is where the price sensitivity gets discovered first. If people are shopping harder, the broker knows before the operator does.
And a broker platform growing while some of the big membership operators are declining.
That's the same bifurcation story again. If you're an on-demand customer and you're feeling price pressure, you don't buy a membership, you shop it. You call a broker. So a strong broker month and a soft membership operator quarter are two views of the exact same customer behavior.
Which makes the fractional double-digit growth even more of an outlier.
Completely. Three totally different demand curves in one industry. That's why I keep saying business aviation is up is a useless sentence right now. Up where? For whom? Source the Air Current.
Let's get into safety. The Air Current has details on the National Transportation Safety Board's preliminary report on the Ryanair accident at Thessaloniki. This is the July 10th event.
And this is a fan blade out on a 737-800.
Right. So the airplane's climbing out of Thessaloniki International, and investigators are examining a suspected bird strike that caused a fan blade out. The result was fuselage damage and a cabin depressurization.
Okay, let's unpack the chain because there's a lot in there. Bird strike into the fan blade departs, and then the question every engineer asks immediately, was it contained?
The reporting describes it as an uncontained style failure sequence with fuselage damage.
Right, and the style qualifier matters because the CFM56 fan case is designed to contain a fan blade. That's a certification requirement. You do the blade off test, you fire a blade at full speed, the case has to hold it, and they generally do hold it.
But the fuselage got damaged.
So the question becomes, what actually hit the airplane? Was it a piece of the blade that came out through the case? Was it cowling and nacelle structure that departed because of the massive imbalance loads? Because when you lose a fan blade, you get an enormous rotating imbalance, and that can tear the nacelle apart, even if the core containment held.
And nacelle debris moving at flight speed into the side of a fuselage
is a projectile. Absolutely. and if it punctures the pressure vessel, you get exactly what they reported, cabin depressurization.
Which means the crew is now managing two emergencies at once.
2.5. You've got an engine failure at low altitude, high thrust setting, worst case moment for asymmetry. You've got a depressurization, and you've likely got significant vibration, which makes every instrument in front of you harder to read and makes the whole airplane feel like it's coming apart.
What's the priority?
Airplane control first, always. But procedurally, the depressurization drives you down and the engine failure drives your performance. So you're descending, which you want to do anyway for the cabin, but you're descending on one engine near terrain you may not have fully briefed, and Thessaloniki has terrain considerations depending on the departure.
This is a crew that did a lot right to end up with an accident report and not something worse.
Enormously right. And I want to make a training point here because I think it's the takeaway for anybody flying transport category or a big cabin jet. We train engine failure. We train depressurization. We almost never train them together. The simulator scenario is almost always a single clean failure with a clean checklist.
And the real world doesn't do that.
The real world does not do that. Real failures cascade. And the crew that's practiced compound failures, where you have to decide which memory items come first and which checklist you're actually running, that crew handles this. The crew that's only ever seen isolated failures has to invent a priority scheme at 4,000 feet with the cabin altitude climbing.
Worth adding to the next recurrent syllabus conversation.
Bring it up with your training department, seriously.
And the bird strike element? Anything actionable there?
Bird strike risk is seasonal and it's local, and it's largely a wildlife management problem at the airport level, not a cockpit problem. What is a cockpit problem is that we tend to think of bird strike as a windshield event or a minor damage event, and it can absolutely be an engine destroying event. If you take a hit on climb out and everything looks normal, you still want to be very deliberate about what you're feeling and hearing for the next several minutes.
Preliminary report though, no probable cause yet.
None. Preliminary is a factual checkpoint. It's what happened, not why. And on a foreign soil accident with a U.S. manufactured airframe and engine, this is going to be a long one. Don't expect conclusions this year.
Completely different corner of the industry. Also from the air current, the U.S. Navy has quietly armed the MQ-25.
Wait, armed the tanker?
Armed the tanker. Boeing's MQ-25 Stingray, which is the uncrewed aerial refueling aircraft for the carrier air wing, was fitted with a GBU-75, that's the Joint Direct Attack Munition Long-Range Cruise Missile, during unpublicized testing aboard the USS Nimitz in June. First time any weapon has been carried by that aircraft.
Okay, that's a big deal, and I want to say why. The MQ-25 was sold politically as a tanker. That was the whole pitch. It's a low-risk, uncontroversial mission. It gives your F-18s their range back. It takes the tanking burden off the Super Hornet fleet. Nobody objects to a flying gas station.
And now it's carrying a weapon.
Now it's a strike platform. Or at least it's demonstrated it could be one. And that's a fundamentally different conversation about autonomy, about rules of engagement, about what an uncrewed aircraft launched off a carrier deck is allowed to do.
Does it change the airplane much?
The airframe? Not necessarily. It's got hard points. It's got payload capacity. It was always going to be physically capable. The change is doctrinal. Once you demonstrate it, planners start assuming it. And a carrier air wing, where a meaningful fraction of your strike capacity is uncrewed and has a much longer loiter time than a crewed fighter, that's a different air wing.
And they did it without publicizing it.
Which is the most interesting part, honestly. You test quietly when you want the capability more than you want the headline.
Okay, that Air India event I mentioned at the top. This one's been all over the pilot forums and it deserves the attention.
Yes, it does.
Air India Flight AI-2379, an A320 operating Phuket to New Delhi. Airbus engineering analysis indicates the aircraft briefly lost key flight control functions during an altitude loss of roughly 300 feet.
Briefly lost key flight control functions. Read that sentence again slowly.
That's the reporting.
On a fly-by-wire Airbus, lost key flight control functions is doing an enormous amount of work in that sentence, and we should be careful about what it probably means versus what it sounds like it means.
Go ahead.
So on an A320, you've got multiple flight control computers. The ELACs and the SECs, elevator aileron computers and spoiler elevator computers, and a set of control laws, normal law, alternate law, direct law, Normal Law is the full protection envelope. It won't let you stall, it won't let you overbank, it limits your load factor.
And when the system loses confidence in its inputs?
It degrades. It drops to alternate law, maybe direct law, and you lose protections. Now, that is not the airplane becoming uncontrollable. The pilots still have control, but the airplane behaves differently than it did 5 seconds ago. And if you're hand flying or if it hands the airplane back to you unexpectedly, that transition is where the altitude loss happens.
So the 300 feet could be the transient, not the failure itself.
That's my read. 300 feet is consistent with a brief control law degradation, a momentary mismatch between what the airplane's doing and what the crew expects, and then recovery. It's not consistent with a catastrophic hardware failure. 300 feet is a startle and recover profile.
But it's not nothing.
It's absolutely not nothing. 300 feet in cruise is a comfortable margin. 300 feet at 1,000 feet on approach is an entirely different story. And more importantly, if there's a systemic reason this happened, it can happen again to a different crew at a worse moment.
And Airbus doing an engineering-level analysis suggests they take it seriously.
Airbus does engineering analyses on these because they have to characterize the failure. Was it a sensor? Air data disagreement? Was it a computer fault? Was it an environmental input? Turbulence? An icing condition on the probes? Those all produce similar cockpit symptoms and completely different fixes.
Is there a crew action item?
Yes, and it's the most boring one in aviation. Know your reversion behavior. Know what your airplane does when it drops out of normal law. Know what the EKM is going to tell you and what it isn't going to tell you. Because the failure mode that hurts you isn't the degradation. It's the 4 seconds where you're trying to figure out why the airplane feels wrong.
Fly the airplane first.
Fly the airplane first, diagnose second, and don't chase the automation. I know that's on every poster in every training center in the world. It's on those posters because it keeps being the answer.
Now let me pull us into some more everyday forum stuff, because there's a great range of it this week. Somebody's getting a Citation 650 type rating next month. First type rating, asking for advice beyond memory items and limitations.
Oh, I love this question. Okay, first type rating advice.
Go.
Number one, and this is the thing nobody tells you, a type rating course is not a flying course. It's an information management course. You are going to be handed more material in 2 weeks than you got in your entire private certificate. The people who struggle are almost never the people who can't fly the airplane. They're the people who fall behind on the systems ground school in week one and never catch up.
So front load.
Front load hard. Whatever they sent you before you arrive, actually do it. Do not show up on day one intending to start.
What else?
Flows. Learn the flows, not just the checklist. The checklist is a verification tool. It's not a do list in a jet. If you're reading the checklist and doing each item as you read it, you're going to be behind the airplane the entire sim session, and the instructor will know within about 90 seconds.
And on the 650 specifically, that's an older airplane.
It's an older airplane, and that's actually part of the value. Steam-adjacent cockpit, depending on the mod state, older autopilot logic, and it will make you a better pilot than something that flies itself. But it also means the system's knowledge has to be deeper because there's less automation covering for you.
Anything on the nerves?
Yeah, everybody's nervous on their first type. The washout rate at the major training providers is much lower than the mythology suggests. They want you to pass. You're a paying customer and their business model depends on you succeeding. Ask questions, admit when you don't understand something, and use the instructors. The candidates who fail are usually the ones who were too proud to say, I don't get this, on day three.
Good advice. There's another thread I want to hit. Somebody with 230 hours, commercial single and multi-instrument certified flight instructor, came out of a Part 141 program and is asking whether Part 141 is a trap.
Because he got the commercial certificate at under 250 hours.
Right. That's the Part 141 benefit, reduced hour requirement.
And now he's sitting there with a commercial certificate and a CFI and not enough hours to do anything with them. And no dual given yet. Yeah, I understand why it feels like a trap.
Is it?
No. But the framing is wrong, and I think the industry sells it badly. Getting your commercial at 210 hours doesn't get you to the airlines faster. The restricted airline transport pilot minimum is what it is. 1,000 hours with a qualifying degree, 1,250 otherwise. Nothing about a fast commercial certificate changes when you hit 1,000 hours.
So what does it actually buy you?
It buys you money. Those 40 hours you didn't have to buy at rental rates, That's real savings. Call it $8,000-$10,000. And it buys you the ability to start instructing earlier, which means you start getting paid to build time earlier, which compounds.
So the trap feeling is really an impatience problem.
It's a timeline expectation problem. And I'd say to that poster specifically, you're a CFI with no dual given. That's the actual bottleneck, not the training pathway. Get hired somewhere, anywhere. The first 100 hours of instruction given are the hardest 100 hours in your career to get, and after that, the phone starts ringing.
There's also a medical certification thread that I think is worth surfacing because it comes up constantly. Someone with a past attention deficit hyperactivity disorder diagnosis, currently unmedicated, plus a failed pre-employment Department of Transportation drug test in their history, asking about a realistic timeline for FAA medical clearance.
Oof. Okay, that's two separate hard problems stacked.
And we should say up front, we are not aviation medical examiners, and this is not medical or legal advice.
Correct. But I can talk about the process shape. The ADHD piece by itself is a well-trodden path. It's not disqualifying on its face, but the FAA is going to want documentation. Often neuropsychological testing, often a period demonstrating you're stable off medication. That is a months-long process, and it is expensive. Four figures, sometimes five.
And the drug test history?
That's the harder one, and that's where the Human Intervention Motivation Study pathway, HIMS, comes into it. And here's my actual advice, which is the same advice for anybody in this situation. Do not walk into an aviation medical examiner's office cold and start answering questions.
Because once you've applied...
Once you've submitted, you're in the system, and the clock and the paperwork are running on the FAA's terms. Talk to a HIMS-trained AME or an aviation medical consultant first on a consultation basis before you file anything. Build the package, then apply. People wreck their own timelines by applying before they're ready and then spending 2 years digging out of a deferral.
That's the recurring lesson in all of these threads, isn't it? Sequence matters.
Sequence matters enormously. And can I say one more thing about the forums generally? There's a post in there from someone who passed their private pilot check ride and felt terrible about it. Weak radio work at a busy towered field, sloppy maneuvers, passed anyway.
The license to learn thing.
Yeah, and I hate that phrase a little because it gets used to excuse bad standards. But the honest truth is, a check ride tests whether you meet the airman certification standards on that day. It does not test whether you're a good pilot. And every single one of us, everyone, has a certificate we passed on a day we didn't deserve to.
That's a healthy thing to admit out loud.
It is. And the right response is exactly what that poster is doing, being uncomfortable about it. The pilot who walks out of a marginal check ride thinking, I crushed that, is the one I'd worry about. Source, Simple Flying.
Let's move to the airline side, and we'll start with the one that happened yesterday. United Flight 1302, Denver to San Diego, August 14th. So that's today, actually, depending on when this reached the wire.
What happened?
A live bullet was discovered in the cabin. All 184 passengers evacuated. Departure delayed roughly 90 minutes.
A live round in the cabin found by crew.
Found by cabin crew, and the reporting quotes someone calling it a security breach.
Well, and it is, definitionally. Something got through screening that shouldn't have. But I want to be careful because the phrase security breach makes people imagine intent, and the overwhelmingly likely explanation here is somebody's loose round in a bag.
That happens more than people think.
It happens constantly. The Transportation Security Administration intercepts thousands of firearms at checkpoints every year, and the number of loose rounds that get found in seat pockets and bags is far higher than the number that make the news. Usually it's a hunter or somebody who carries, and there's a round in a jacket pocket or rolling around in the bottom of a backpack.
Does that make it less serious?
Less alarming, not less serious. A single round with no firearm is not a meaningful threat. You can't do much with it. But the fact that it got through screening tells you something about screening performance on that day at that checkpoint. And that's what the follow-up investigation is actually about.
And a full evacuation for 90 minutes.
Which is the right call and also an expensive one. Once you've got an unexplained object of that nature on board, you can't just pick it up and move on. You've got to get people off, you've got to secure the aircraft, you've got to let law enforcement work it. And that airplane and that crew are now out of position for the rest of the day, which ripples.
Different kind of disruption. Delta, day before, August 13th. Flight DL 1334, an A321. Registration November 363, Delta November, Atlanta to Fort Lauderdale. Return to Atlanta about 15 minutes after departure.
Reason?
Technical malfunction with smoke reported.
Smoke. Okay, so that's a return, no discussion. There's no version of a smoke indication where you continue to destination.
15 minutes out is an interesting window.
It's actually a good window, operationally. You're close enough to your departure field that it's clearly your best option. You're still relatively light on fuel, so you're probably not overweight for landing, and you know the field. 15 minutes out and returning is about the most manageable version of a smoke event you can have.
Versus mid-Atlantic.
Versus mid-Atlantic, or versus 40 minutes into a two-hour leg where suddenly your nearest suitable is somewhere you've never been with a shorter runway and no maintenance.
The smoke and fumes checklist is one of the aggressive ones.
It's the most aggressive one in the book. And deliberately, because smoke in an airplane has a very short fuse. The historical record on in-flight fire is brutal. You have a very limited amount of time from first indication to loss of control if it's a real fire. So the philosophy is, assume the worst, get on the ground, sort it out later.
And most of the time, it turns out to be a galley oven or a bleed issue.
Most of the time, it's benign. Doesn't matter. You don't get to know that in advance, and the cost of being wrong in the other direction is total.
Okay. Let's talk manufacturers. Airbus is beating Boeing on deliveries in 2026.
Back to normal then.
351 aircraft in the first half of the year, and they look on course to finish ahead for the full year. And Simple Flying notes that Boeing actually outpaced Airbus in the first quarter, which was the first time that had happened since 2019.
Which is genuinely notable and I think got underreported at the time. Boeing had a good Q1. That's a company that's been in the wilderness for 6 or 7 years, posting a quarter where they out-delivered Airbus.
And then it didn't hold.
It didn't hold. And the reason it didn't hold is the same reason it's been hard for both of them. Supply chain. Engines, specifically. Both airframers can build airplanes faster than the engine makers can deliver engines, and you cannot deliver a glider.
Gliders on the ramp.
Gliders on the ramp. And the working capital cost of 100 nearly complete airplanes sitting around waiting for power plants is enormous. That's billions of dollars parked on concrete.
What does the delivery race actually mean for operators, though? Is it just scoreboard?
Partly scoreboard. But it matters for two real reasons. One, delivery slots. If Airbus is executing better, their slot commitments are more credible, and if you're an airline planning capacity 3 years out, credibility of delivery date is worth real money. Two, it affects the used market. Every new airplane delivered is potentially an older airplane freed up, and that flows down through the lessors into secondary markets.
Which touches business aviation eventually, too.
Everything touches everything. There's a related piece in the same batch about Pratt and Whitney, actually, about how they essentially traded the wide-body engine market for narrow-body dominance.
Yeah, walk through that, because Pratt used to be one of the big three on large commercial aircraft.
They were. The PW4000 family powered early 777s, A330s, 767s, 747s. Pratt was everywhere on wide bodies. And then over about two decades, they essentially ceded that ground.
To GE and Rolls.
To GE and Rolls-Royce, yeah. GE took the big twin market with the GE90 and then the GE-NX and the GE9X. Rolls took a big chunk with the Trent family, and Pratt went all in on the geared turbofan for narrow bodies.
Was that a strategic choice or a retreat?
Bit of both. And I think honest people at Pratt would say the same. The exclusivity deal on the GE90 for the 777 essentially locked them out of that airplane. And once you miss a generation on wide bodies, you don't get back in. The development cost is $10 billion, and the order book is 30 years long.
So they bet the company on the geared architecture.
Bet the company. And technically, the geared turbofan is a genuinely brilliant piece of engineering. The fuel burn numbers are real. The noise numbers are real. The execution has been painful. The powder metal contamination issue grounded huge portions of the A320neo fleet, and the durability problems in hot and harsh environments have been a running sore for operators.
But the market position is huge.
Enormous. Half the neo fleet plus the A220 plus the E2. That's a colossal installed base and an even more colossal aftermarket revenue stream for the next 30 years. So, retreat from wide bodies, dominance in narrow bodies. Which market would you rather own?
Narrow bodies, probably.
Narrow bodies by a mile. There are far more of them, and they fly far more cycles.
Couple more quick ones from Simple Flying. There's an analysis of Form 41 filings suggesting the 787-10 is the cheapest wide body to operate in U.S. service on a direct cost basis.
The Dash 10, that tracks actually.
Why?
because it's the stretched version of an already efficient airframe. You're carrying the same two engines, the same crew, the same fixed costs, and you're spreading them over substantially more seats. The Dash 10 is range limited compared to the Dash 9. It doesn't do the ultra long thin routes, but on transatlantic and dense domestic, the seat mile economics are outstanding.
And then some corporate news. EasyJet is reportedly evaluating commercial agreements with Air France KLM. Codeshare, Interline, that kind of thing. This is after Apollo Global Management's £5.7 billion takeover of EasyJet.
Wait, Apollo bought EasyJet? That's the part I want to sit on for a second.
£5.7 billion. Roughly $7.7 billion.
Private equity, buying a major European low-cost carrier, and then immediately exploring a tie-up with a legacy flag carrier group. That is a strategy you can read from space. You're building feed, you're taking a point-to-point short-haul network and plugging it into a long-haul hub operation.
Which EasyJet has historically refused to do.
Refused! The whole low-cost orthodoxy is no interline, no connections, no baggage transfer, because connections are where your on-time performance and your cost structure go to die. Ryanair has been dogmatic about this for 30 years.
So this is a real philosophical shift.
It's a philosophical shift, and it's a very private equity thing to do. You buy the asset, you find the revenue synergy that the previous management was too culturally committed to ignore, you monetize it, you exit. Whether it's good for the long-term operation is a different question.
And last one, American Airlines shuffled its senior management on August 13th.
Because the revenue performance isn't converting into profitability against Delta and United.
That's the framing. CEO Robert Isom essentially acknowledging that the numbers aren't where they need to be relative to the competition.
And this is the story American has been living for a decade. They fly a lot of people. Their revenue line is big. Their margin line is not, relative to Delta especially. And the gap is mostly in premium and in corporate share.
The corporate travel share they gave up.
That was the self-inflicted one, and they've been trying to claw it back ever since. Look, management reshuffles are the easiest thing to announce and the hardest thing to evaluate. Ask me in 18 months. But the diagnosis, that revenue without margin is a structural problem, not a cyclical one. That diagnosis is correct. Source, Liam News.
Speaking of manufacturers finding their footing, Liam News has kicked off a four-part series on Embraer's recovery, and part one is out.
Oh, this is a great story. This is one of the best corporate survival stories in modern aerospace, and nobody talks about it.
So the setup, between 2017 and 2020, Embraer faced successive existential threats. Airbus acquires a controlling stake in Bombardier's C-Series, which becomes the A220. Then Boeing walks away from a proposed joint venture. Then COVID.
And you have to understand how bad that sequence was. The Airbus C-Series deal was the first hit. Suddenly, the A220 has the world's biggest commercial aircraft sales organization behind it, and that airplane competes directly with the top of the E-Jet range.
So Embraer's response was to find a partner of their own.
Exactly. The Boeing joint venture was defensive. It was Embraer saying, "We cannot compete against Airbus's distribution on our own, so we'll take Boeing's." And they restructured the entire company around that deal, carved out the commercial aviation unit, set up the corporate structure, spent a fortune on it.
And Boeing withdrew.
Boeing withdrew in April 2020 in the middle of the pandemic and left Embraer holding a company that had been surgically prepared for a marriage that wasn't going to happen. And then the entire regional aircraft market evaporated for 2 years.
How do you come back from that?
Well, and this is the part of the story I find genuinely instructive. They diversified. The commercial jet business is one leg. But Embraer also has the executive jets business, the Phenoms and the Praetors, which matter a lot to our audience. And they have defense, which is the KC-390. And in the last few years, all three have been working at once.
The KC-390 is actually in the news elsewhere today. Simple Flying's got a piece noting it's won orders from multiple NATO air forces as a C-130 replacement.
Right, and the headline framing there is that the U.S. Air Force still won't touch it, which, I mean, of course they won't. That's not a product judgment. That's Lockheed and its domestic industrial base politics, and it's the fact that the U.S. has an enormous existing Hercules infrastructure. Nobody expected the KC-390 to win in America.
But five NATO air forces, with interest from seven European operators.
That's the real win. And the pitch is straightforward. It's a jet, so it's faster and it flies higher than a turboprop. Hercules, it's got a modern cockpit, it does the tanker role natively, and it's cheaper to acquire. For a mid-size European Air Force replacing 30-year-old C-130s, that's a very compelling package.
And for Embraer, defense revenue is countercyclical to commercial.
Which is the whole point. When the airline stopped ordering in 2020, defense kept going. That diversification is why they survived. And it's the lesson for anybody watching manufacturers. A single product aerospace company is a company that's one bad cycle from disappearing.
The E2 program has taken a while to build momentum.
It has. And part one of that Liam series gets into it. The E2 is a fine airplane, better economics, geared turbofan, quieter. But it ran headfirst into the scope clause problem in the United States, where the regional pilot contracts limit aircraft weight and seat count, and the E2 in its most compelling configuration doesn't fit. So its natural biggest market was closed to it.
Which is a market structure problem, not an engineering problem.
Entirely a market structure problem. And it's why Embraer's growth on the E2 has been international rather than North American. I'm looking forward to the rest of that series. Liam does the kind of long-form manufacturer analysis that basically nobody else is doing anymore.
Couple of video side items to close out. Beta Technologies again. They're back at Farnborough with something new. The MB250.
Hold on, this is different from the Alia?
Completely different. It's a hybrid electric autonomous vertical takeoff and landing aircraft built for defense. 2,000-pound payload, 250 nautical mile range.
Hybrid, not pure electric.
Hybrid.
Okay, that's the whole story right there. And I think it's the most honest thing anybody in this sector has done in a while. Beta has been the pure electric company, the battery-only company. And they've just shipped a product that says, for this mission, batteries alone don't get there yet.
Is that a retreat?
No, it's maturity. Look at the mission. Contested logistics. Moving 2,000 pounds of stuff 250 miles into places you can't put a runway and can't put a crew at risk. There is no battery chemistry available today that does that with useful payload. So you add a generator, you use the battery for the vertical phase where you need peak power, and you cruise on the engine.
And the defense customer doesn't care about emissions.
The defense customer does not care about emissions at all. What the defense customer cares about is range, payload, and whether it needs a person in it. An uncrewed 2,000 pounds, 250 nautical miles, no runway, is a genuinely valuable capability that doesn't currently exist.
So this could fund the civil programs.
That's exactly the play. And it's the smart play. Defense money is patient, and it's not chasing a certification basis that doesn't exist yet. Military airworthiness is a different and frankly more flexible path. So you take defense revenue, you use it to survive the civil certification slog, and you come out the other side with both. If I'm a beta investor, this is the announcement I wanted.
Totally different end of the spectrum. There's a Luscom Corporation update out this week, and the pitch is basically, you want cheap aviation, here it is. A 1946 Luscom 8A for $25,000.
$25,000 for an airplane.
For a flying airplane.
And I know exactly what everyone listening is thinking, because I'm thinking it too. $25,000 for the airplane, and then what does it cost to keep it?
That's always the question.
That's always the question. But honestly, a 8A with a small Continental on it is about as cheap as certified aviation gets. Tailwheel, fabric, or metal depending on the model, sips fuel, parts are findable. If you want to fly for fun and not go anywhere fast, that's a legitimate answer.
There's also the type certificate story underneath it.
Yeah, and that's the part that matters longer term. Legacy type certificates changing hands is how orphaned fleets either get supported or die. If somebody's actually going to produce parts and support the certificate, that's meaningful for every Luscom owner out there. If it's just an asset getting traded, it isn't.
And last one. Team USA's Unlimited Aerobatic Squad is training in Union City, Tennessee for the World Aerobatic Championships. Jeff Borboon, Greg Gifford, Britt Lincoln.
The Unlimited category is the most demanding stick and rudder flying on the planet, and I will fight anybody about that.
Make the case.
It's the precision. Everybody focuses on the G-loads and the gyroscopic figures, and those are impressive. But what they're actually being judged on is whether a line is exactly 45 degrees, whether a roll rate is perfectly constant, whether the airplane exits a figure on the exact heading it entered, in a box, with wind, under time pressure, with judges on the ground who will find every degree you're off.
And they emphasize consistency and mental discipline in the training.
Which is the tell. Anybody can fly a great sequence once. Flying the same sequence identically 10 times in a row when you're tired and dehydrated and it's the third flight of the day, that's the skill. And that's honestly not that different from what we ask of a line pilot on day 4 of a trip.
The consistency under fatigue.
Consistency under fatigue. Different airplane, same discipline.
All right, let's put a bow on it. What are you carrying out of today, Sam?
Two things. One, the fuel number, 831, up 70 cents in a month, up $1.70 on the year. If you have any input into your operations fuel strategy, this week is the week to revisit tankering, contract fuel, and how your surcharge mechanism actually works. Because the margin hit is happening now, and the recovery is happening later.
And two?
Two is the compound failure thing. That Ryanair sequence, engine failure plus depressurization at low altitude, and the Air India control law event. Different airplanes, different causes, same lesson. We train single clean failures and the world delivers cascades. Go ask your training department when the last time was you saw two things break at once in the box.
Good. Mine's the split in the demand data. Fractionals up 10 and 11%, membership and on-demand operators down, brokers posting record months. That's not one market, that's three. And if you're making planning decisions off an industry-wide average right now, you're going to make a bad one.
Yeah. Business aviation is up is a sentence that means nothing this quarter.
That's the Flight Logic Brief for Friday, August 14th, 2026. We're back Monday morning.
Fly safe, check your fuel receipts, and I'll see you Monday.
Take care, everybody.